Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, and welcome back to the Longform Podcast. I am Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Happy New Year, Max. How are you going to kick off the new year for the show?
It's a new year. It's a new us. And I talked to Katie Vine. Katie Vine is an executive editor at Texas Monthly. She has written for Texas Monthly for a long time. It is actually the only place that she has ever worked, as we talked about in this interview. She's been there for 25 years, Texas Monthly about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. And we talked about that arc and how she finds stories in Texas and why she is so interested in con men. And I was also in Texas for the holidays, visiting some family. And so we got to do this interview in person at the Texas Monthly offices, which was nice. It's so nice to do these things in person, particularly in the state of Texas.
It seems like 1,000 years ago that we used to have like a landlocked cubicle in the Atavist office and people would show up every week to talk to us. I don't even remember. I think the last time I did it in person was maybe when Evan came to my house, but that doesn't count. So yeah, here's to the glory days of getting to meet all these people. Was great. Also great staying at home all the time and taping remotely. Everyone wins. We are brought to you in partnership with Vox Media. They help us make this show. Thanks to everyone over at Vox.
And now here's Max with Katie Vine.
Hi, Katie.
Hey, Max.
Look at us in a proper studio.
It's cozy.
It's cozy, but it's also kind of spacious. We are at your podcast studio at the offices of Texas Monthly.
Yeah.
It's making me feel very nostalgic. I've spent some time in these offices.
Oh, yeah.
And I haven't been here in a long time. And it is wonderful to be here. I realized I was walking over here thinking about talking to you and realized that I know your work really well, and I have some sense of your arc at Texas Monthly, which is now 25 years.
Yeah.
Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know before Texas Monthly at all.
You want to hear that?
Uh-huh, I do, yeah. How did you get here?
I was filing paperwork in the basement of the Department of Public Safety, crying every day.
Yeah, that sounds thrilling.
That's what I was doing. So there was no internet, right? I just didn't know what I was doing. And I had worked mostly in fiction and then graduated from college. And I was like, oh, crap, I didn't have a trust fund. How am I going to do that? And to pay bills, yeah, I was filing DWI paperwork and then making appointments for people with the judges. And it was about as depressing as you can imagine. But the beauty of having a job like that, I feel like, is it kind of kicks your ass into really like doing something else. I mean, I had friends who worked in better, like more fun jobs with people they really liked.
Sounds like kind of a low bar.
Well, you're early 20s, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, like I was 21 and then, you know, I got here and it was like, what am I going to do? But then I remember in the library, the central library, second floor, there was this big blue book and it said something like media jobs. And I went to the Austin section and I just this is going to date it, faxed my resume just all over. And I remember, like, the Lakeway Gazette wouldn't take me because they were very suspicious of, like, what is an intern? What is that? And then Texas Monthly called, and they did not have a spot in editorial, but they had a spot as Mike Levy's intern, who was the founder and publisher. At the time, I had no idea why there would be this availability to be his intern. Like, why would nobody want that? And then I learned very quickly why people weren't just clamoring for that internship. He was very tough, but passionate and confident. And I learned a lot from him. And I remember there was he made me do something called a transmittal, where it's before email, right? So he'd clip out any newspaper article he thought everybody on staff needed to read, whether it be about, you know, the publishing business or about Texas, how Texas was changing, anything like that. He wanted us all to kind of be informed and on the same page. Of course, we all had to read all the newspapers every morning anyway, but just in case we missed a particular story, he wanted us all to have the same language and the same understandings. So he would clip it out, and he would put it in this file, and at the end of the week, I had to cut them with an X-Acto knife so that it would be a perfect, and then tape it onto a white sheet and then photocopy that for however 100 and some employees. And then everybody, he would quiz people in the hall, like, did you read page 35 of the transmittal this week, you know, and then, like, ask you questions about it. But one time I got a thumbprint, because it's all newsprint, right? Uh-huh. And I got a thumbprint on the tape. And he made me do it all over.
Really?
Yeah. And I told him this recently, and he apologized because he knows he could be a little much. But it was like that. I mean, if you left your coffee mug on your desk, you'd get a note like, I am not your secretary or something like that. But he would always, your blinds had to be at a certain 45 degrees. Like,
whoa.
He was very particular. But, you know, he also told people, we're going to put out a great magazine, and everybody believed it.
Do you think you have to be like a psycho about curtain angles in order to have that kind of ambition?
I think you have to believe that you could, that it could happen even without any experience.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's how a lot of things are.
Yeah, I think that's true. But at that point, Texas Monthly had been around for, what, 25 years?
Yeah.
It done some pretty great work.
Yeah.
Maybe you can relax about the thumbprints and the curtains a little bit. So how long did you stay in the photocopy game?
I think I was his intern for 3 months, and then I moved over to edit.
And what did you want to be doing then?
I don't think I knew. I didn't want to be filing DWI paperwork. It was, I mean, talk about low bar. I just knew what I couldn't handle. And luckily, I just got along great with the editor at that time, was Greg Curtis. And someone left. I took someone's spot who thought it would be a better gig to go up and sell hot dogs at the Round Rock baseball stadium. That she thought, she was like, screw this, I'm going to go. And it was just, I mean, it was, I think the pay was $19,000,
mm-hmm.
which was more than I had been making. So I thought I was, like, really in the money.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there were a lot of factors. There was the dot-com boom. I remember at the time, long form was dead. Everybody was saying long form's dead. Nobody's going to read long form anymore. And so I was like, great. Like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I can, you know, and then I didn't do longer stories for a while, but started with small interviews and doing a calendar of events. That was my main job. I was supposed to do the calendar, and then everything else was just for fun. I would do reporting stories, and my office was right across from, luckily, Sam Gwynn, who, his confidence could, like, run the state, like, just by his own personal electricity. He had enough confidence. I didn't have any. And he would be like, that's a great story. You should do, and that's, like, the most epic story. You should do a big feature on that. I was like, what are you talking about? And so I think just sitting across from him, like, made me think, maybe I can do this. All right, let's do it.
So you wanted to be writing long stories then, even while you're doing the calendar stuff,
yeah,
and
yeah.
taking these little reporting shots, that was the goal?
Yeah. Because, I mean, everybody in the room was.
Did you have a kind of story that you wanted to be doing?
Subculture stories. That's what I really loved in the beginning. That sort of started me down that line of getting interested in, like, just little worlds, So then I did one on the circus, like a three-person circus family that mm-hmm. traveled around. And I traveled with them for a while. Things like that. I loved doing that. And the reporting's always a blast. And the people aren't, like, famous. So they'll talk to you. And yeah. they want their story told. And they're proud of what they do. And I just think they're so fun.
It's amazing to think about that moment in time. I mean, I guess that's kind of always been true of this place, that there were these incredible writers at the absolute top of their game. But it's amazing to think about you being young and new to this, and like, what was it like for you to be around that? Was it like inspiring or intimidating or both?
It was and is very supportive. It never felt intimidating in a way that was negative.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, the older writers were always very, and still feel very much like, you know, sort of uncles and aunts to me. And
does that seem unique to Texas
Monthly?
I
don't know. You tell me. I don't know other places.
It didn't feel competitive.
No. Not to me. It's never felt competitive. It's very, very collaborative, and we come up with stories for each other a lot. Don't always take the stories that you think that each other should do, mm-hmm. but that's all. That's and with the people who are more my own age, you know, basically sat next to each other, you know, before laptops, mm-hmm. Every day for at least 10 years, and then. Unless you were reporting, you were sitting next to those people. So they knew your personal problems. They knew your professional problems. Like, we just knew all each other's business and could help usually, like, with if you're stuck on a story, you know.
Do you think there's some aspect of that that's about Texas Monthly's place in the state and how few other places are doing it? Like, there weren't a lot of other Texas Monthlies that were competing with this one. In a way that feels distinct to, say, like, mm-hmm. the many, many magazines in New York,
right?
Where there's some aspect of competition and also people are moving around a bunch. And I just, the way that you're describing that culture feels a little bit different to me than the way that people have described the New Yorker or the New York Times Magazine or places like that. I think, doesn't sound quite as familial to me.
Maybe, I mean, it could be, I don't know why that was always the way it operated, but... I can't think of many times when a writer ever would have said something negative to a younger writer, or even about them in a way that they'd ever hear back. Like I can't imagine that. It just wasn't the culture of it.
Seems great.
Yeah, totally. And I hope it's still. I mean, I hope it still feels that way to some of the younger folks coming up. It's different because everybody has laptops and homework. People work from home and all that.
Mm-hmm. What else is different about Texas Monthly now than when you started?
I mean, you've gone through different owners.
Yeah.
You know.
How's that situation now?
Our hand is amazing. I mean, it's a whole new world. It's like, where have you been all my life?
Because there were some rocky moments.
I mean, there have been many. There were definitely times, I think I can say this at this point, when we were owned by a company that owned a lot of radio stations. And there was a time when the magazine industry in general was going kind of down the tubes. But it really felt like, just turn out the lights when you're done. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed like, enjoy it while it lasts, because give yourself another 2 years, and mm-hmm. then you're going to have to, like, figure out, like, what other line of work you're gonna do, you know? I mean, it definitely felt like that. But
it felt like that to me from the outside, for what was gonna happen here. Did you think about what else we would do?
No.
Just back to the office of public safety.
I just stuck my head in the sand and be like, we're just gonna keep doing the work and see what happens.
That seems like actually like a quite positive response to a moment like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe.
I mean, what else are you going to do?
What else? I had no plan. I don't want to do anything else. I like this. And I think I had the most a younger writer was up here one time and said that some of her friends thought, you know, when I was, I think I was referencing some old stories that I really liked, and she said, you know, a lot of my friends feel like those are, that's just really a precious way to think about it. And it just broke my heart. I was like, this is a whole thing that I guess is, there's a group of people who, I mean, I knew there were people who never cared about it. Totally fine. I get that.
Sure.
But like people who I thought would care about it and that they were going away too.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons I didn't understand at all. Because I was like, that should totally be the audience for long form stories. And if they don't like it, that feels weird. Like, why? I don't know if it's got too sort of formal for a lot of people or too stuffy. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely changed. You've watched the evolution of style over the time that you've just been doing long form. Like, how would you describe it?
I feel like the thing that has changed, but this is probably pretty specific to my experience, is that I think that fewer young people who are really talented storytellers are choosing this medium as a place to work. And I think it's because it feels less viable.
Yeah, you can't make a living.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
can.
I think it's I think it has a lot to do with the economics of it. You know, the barrier to entry is really high.
Yeah.
The number of slots feel really low.
Mm-hmm. And there's no pipeline anymore.
Yeah. So that's what feels the most distinct to me, which is also quite sad. I just think it doesn't feel realistic.
Yeah.
That's a bummer. That all makes me bummed out. Can we just talk about stories for a little while?
Yeah.
I will say, like, before I ask you about your stories, it feels good in here.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in a nice studio.
These guys have a good vibe.
There's like your office is in downtown Austin.
Yeah.
It's got big, feels like a magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it feel that way to you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there was a while when it didn't, because we moved over by the highway briefly, and there was this, I remember trying to describe to somebody who was coming up for an interview where it was, and I said, look for the building in the middle of a field near the highway where you think, that can't be it, and take a right. Enter the parking lot. Yeah, that was a brief period, and now we're back downtown. We've been here for a while, and this is an amazing building. View of the Capitol. I mean, it's pretty awesome. I know some people at a certain point have said, you know, like, I want to go do some stories outside of Texas. I don't care about that.
You never had that itch?
No. I mean, this is a huge state. There's so much. And and it's different everywhere you look. I mean, especially you just go to Houston and there's like worlds within worlds within worlds just in the one city. So you go to San Antonio and you're like in a different country, and you go to Dallas, you're in a totally different country. I mean, it's just, I just feel like it's every area you drive a few hours and you're someplace that, where the people are slightly different from where you just left. It's just, it's wild to me. It's endlessly fascinating.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
All right, let's talk about your stories. Can we talk about some stories?
Let's talk stories.
All right. I don't know how to talk to you about your stories and not start with the fruitcake story.
Okay.
Maybe you could briefly give the synopsis of the fruitcake story.
Yes.
And then we can talk a little bit about con men.
Okay. Sandy Jenkins was a 50-some-year-old second-level accountant. He had one guy over him in accounting in a company called the Collins Street Bakery, which is considered the greatest fruitcake company in the world. Thank you very much. And they're up in Corsicana, just southeast of Dallas. And I think they say 50 miles in 100 years previous to Dallas, something like that.
I can't remember
what the saying is.
50 miles in 100 years south of Dallas.
South of Dallas. And then he one day decided to start embezzling money. And after 7 or 8 years, had quietly embezzled $17 million.
$17 million.
$17 million is a lot.
It's a lot of fruitcake.
Yeah.
And he wasn't quiet about it.
No.
He was splashing money around.
Totally. Because he wanted to impress. This is what I thought was so fun about this story is, no matter where you live, there's probably going to be some group that folks in that town want to impress, mm-hmm. whether it's New York City or Dallas or Corsicana. And in Corsicana, he wanted to impress the muckety mucks of that town, which is just the funniest thing in the world to me. But, you know, that's how it is everywhere. And he was willing to talk with me. The feds were willing to talk and kind of reveal how they were able to find him and figure things out. The people at the bakery were remarkably open about it. And Bob McNutt, his real name, Bob McNutt, owner of the Fruitcake Company, was all for it.
Why was he all for it, do you think?
He's a funny guy. I think
this is a guy who had $17 million stolen from him.
And under his own nose. He's making jokes.
Yeah.
Totally. I love that guy. And he wasn't just making jokes to me. He was making jokes all over town.
Totally.
And when they did when they auctioned off, you know, after Sandy got busted and they were auctioning off all of his many, many, furs and watches and wines and, oh, God, he just had so much stuff in his house. So they had the auction and people were lined up down the block. And Bob McNutt is going up and down the line with a bunch of cookies, you know, chatting people up and making jokes.
And trying to get him to pay top dollar because he was going to get...
he's going to get some of the proceeds.
Great, he was going to get everything from the sale.
Yeah.
It's almost like everyone in that story, including Sandy, who stole $17 million, and Bob, who had $17 million stolen from him, kind of thought it was funny.
Kind of. I mean, I'm sure it sucked.
Yeah.
But also...
it's just pretty funny to steal $17 million from a fruitcake company.
And Sandy, he would go back and forth. Some days he would, you know, show a lot of regret. Other days he would be like, you know what? I'd do it again. It was worth it. Screw these people. You know? And he gained notoriety from his fellow inmates, a respect that he never got on the outside. And I remember him talking about that, and he was like, you know, they think I'm hot shit, mm-hmm. you know? I got away with more than anybody in here. There's serious respect for that.
There's something in that story which felt similar to me to some other ones you've written. So mm-hmm. you wrote about a guy who... was doing really high-end insurance scams.
Uh-huh.
Crashing planes.
Yeah, yeah.
To collect the insurance money.
Yeah.
And it felt like there were two things in common in those stories. Mm-hmm. One was you spent a lot of time, particularly in the first third or first half of the story, really operating from their vantage point. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of times in those con men stories, it starts with the victims. And with both Sandy and TR, you really spent a lot of time trying to figure out where they were at.
Uh-huh.
And who they were and what would lead them to that. And then
The other part that felt similar to me was that the stakes felt low, even though the amount of money felt high. Does that sound right to you?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure.
Like, Bob McNutt's walking around making jokes. Like, no one really got hurt that bad.
Right. And insurance for TR, it's like, right. It's, the victims are like, insured.
Yeah. I guess they're like, they're sympathetic characters in a way. Right. And I wonder what draws you to characters like that.
Well, I think I'm a pretty serious goody-two-shoes, and I'm endlessly fascinated by people who are like, screw it, no rules, not anymore. Especially with Sandy, that was funny because, like, I think he had been very law-abiding before that, and then just one day he's like, forget it. TR had been a con artist, I think, most of his life. I mean, if he ever listens to this, I don't think that would surprise him that I feel that way. You know, we were pretty frank in our discussions, and he, you know, there's just sort of maybe narcissism, I think, at play that I think is fascinating. And, you know, it's different from a violent offender. And I had done some of those, and I think I like the narrative drive of a crime, but I got real tired of thinking about violence. I got real tired of that. And so having the narrative drive of crime, but white-collar crime, all of a sudden it was like, oh, so I can have my cake and eat it too.
That makes sense to me, and that connects even to the story you wrote about the very short-term
mayor
of Gun Barrel City.
Yeah.
Also the same thing, like,
yeah,
incredible character.
Totally. Wanted to talk and talk and talk about how he did it, why he did it.
It's funny, you were saying that before when you were talking about these stories from subcultures that you like to write and how people are proud of what they're doing and want to talk.
Yeah.
Is that something that you look for in a story, that you don't have to, like, pry someone open, that they're pre-pried?
That's how I prefer it. And that's probably why I have steered away from doing investigative stuff, because if people don't want to talk, I'm generally like, not it. I mean, I can and have, but it's not when I'm doing my best and enjoying myself the most. I like it when someone wants to tell me their story, whether they're guilty or innocent. I mean, I just think that's, you're going to get more juice, you know.
Do you think there's also like an element in which it feels like you're not like tricking someone into talking to you?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I think this is universal, but particularly what I found in Texas is there is an, I'm going to say ego, but I don't mean it in a bad way. I think it's good, where a lot of folks are like, yeah, what I do is a big deal and it's important and it's critical that the world hear what I do when I'm making boots or whatever it is. I think there is something that's in a lot of people where they want people to know that what they do is a big deal. It's fun and energizing to hear people talk like that, no matter what they do.
And that feels like a Texan thing to you?
I think some of the swagger is. Mm-hmm. I think some of that is because, you know, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I think some of the questions that I would, if I were to ask a farmer in Wisconsin, the response would not be, of course you want to hear this.
Right.
Of course the world needs to know, and sit down and let me tell you for a few days, like, how this came to be, how I came to form this empire. I don't want to make it sound like a bad thing, because I like it, especially as a storyteller. I love it.
When was the last time you were bored?
I don't remember. Do you remember?
Yeah, I was bored yesterday.
I don't know. Because, I mean, the beauty of working at this place really is, if you are having a problem, it's a problem of your own making. Like, you can pretty much do almost any kind of story you want, as long as it's like you're doing a good job and you're thoughtful about the way you're doing it and you're working with the editors. But my experience has been, if you're having a problem, it's your problem, and only you can fix it. Nobody's making you do anything you don't want to do.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet gig.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty great.
Do you like managing people?
No, I've never had to do it.
So you never had to do it?
No.
You don't do it now?
Nope.
What's your job now?
What do you do for a living? I just write. I'm just a reporter. Uh-huh.
What's your title?
I'm an executive editor.
You don't have to manage anyone if you're the executive editor?
No.
What does that mean? What does that title mean?
So I think the titles, for a long time I used to joke that you would get a title change when they ran out of money. Because that seemed to be how it worked.
Uh-huh.
They'd be like, well, we'll make you an assistant editor. It's like, okay, well, I guess that sounds good. But, you know, okay, well, maybe more people will return my phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, I always feel like all of the titles on magazine mastheads are hilarious because there's so many. I mean, what do any of them mean? Like, unless you actually call it what it is, copy editors, fact checkers, like, you know that. But for the most part, blank, blah, blank editor, I mean.
Doesn't mean shit.
No.
Wow, I feel like the scales are falling from my eyes right now. Are you working on a couple of different feature ideas all the time?
I try to, yes, because I found that if I don't, I'm screwed.
You got to have a couple burners on.
Yeah, totally, because something's going to fall apart.
How do things fall apart?
People back out. People die.
You've had people die?
Yes. The most random things, I feel like, can cause a story to fall apart, but you should just see it coming. Just assume. Sort of assume. This is why I think I'd be a terrible freelancer too. I always assume the worst, and even here, a lot of times when I'm pitching an editor on a story, I'm like, I think this is really good, but it could all go south real fast. And here are the many ways that this story might not work and might be like your worst nightmare. This, and you can sort of see that they, after a while, I hope after they get to know me, they're like, it's fine, but. Yeah, I don't think that would fly. I've heard really good freelancers sometimes, like, overheard them telling an editor-in-chief, like, here's why you should do this story. And the confidence is just, like, over the moon, you know. It's like, oh, this story's going to be the greatest thing.
Yeah, it's like sales.
And it's totally sales. I would suck at that. I remember hearing those, and I would just be like, I can think of all the ways your story is going to suck, you know. Even if everybody cooperates, this is a problem, that's a problem. Yeah, you can see that stuff coming a mile away. But if the planets align, it can work.
Does the writing come easily to you?
Not good writing. Writing, yes, but not good writing doesn't. But I'll do the chiselers and the pukers. I can't remember. I think it might have been Calvin Trillin who came up with the chislers and the pukers. I'm a puker. And so I could say it's very easy to write garbage, which I usually do. I'll do my notebook dump into an outline and then take the outline and do a really terrible draft that basically looks like the outline in paragraph form. And then I'll print that out and start with a fresh screen and basically redo it. And do that process over and over. If it's really bad, sometimes I'll even like try to trick myself because it'll be so depressing to look at it. And you're just like, oh, this sucks so bad that I'll turn it back into an outline. You know what I mean?
You'll de-draft it.
De-draft it. Like just so that there's lower stakes. Like, this isn't a paragraph.
Yeah.
This is an outline.
This isn't even
for
writing.
The greatest story ever. But it's just not written yet.
That sounds like a time-consuming process.
It is, except that I'm a fast typist. I'm a very fast typist. I could be like a court reporter.
Doesn't appeal much to you, though.
No. Although, I think they make money.
You worried about making money?
Well,
I mean, you started here 25 years ago.
Yeah.
making 19 grand.
The slow climb from now, 19 grand.
Now you're an executive editor, right. Which apparently doesn't mean anything.
Well, it's nice.
I'm just kidding.
But it's not, I don't manage people.
But do you worry about money?
I mean, I'm in journalism. So it's not Wall Street, you know. But it's, you're never going to, like, get rich as a writer on a magazine writer. I mean, I'm sure there are some, but I don't think anybody goes into this thinking, like, I'm going to make the bucks.
Totally. I'm trying to understand the relationship that you have to this place and to your job.
Yeah.
Because I have to tell you,
yeah,
talked to a fair number of magazine writers in the last, call it 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think I've had a conversation like this one.
What do you mean? Well, oh, because they're all depressed?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Everyone's,
right.
I just think it's worth being honest about it.
Right.
People are depressed.
Yeah.
Freaked out.
Yeah, yeah.
Feel like their chosen profession is less viable all the time.
Mm-hmm. But it was like that when I got into it. That's how, I mean, I think that's why I don't care anymore. That was the vibe when I, in 1997, that was the feeling. It was like, well, this ship's going under. And I was like, I'm on board. Welcome.
Just throwing my life preserver off the side.
Totally.
Well, I think my question.
I mean, that's so positive.
Well,
I'm a positive person.
I think what I'm trying to figure out is it you? Is it this place?
Hmm.
Again, I've talked to a lot of magazine writers in the last couple of years, and I don't think I've heard anyone, including people who have made a ton of money, sound quite as content as you.
That might be bad. Contentment is supposed to be like a sin, right?
Well,
yeah.
I wouldn't think of it that way.
Right.
I would think of it as a... real oasis in this magazine journalism conversation I've been having for years.
Yeah. You know, we are currently protected from a lot of garbage. And I think during the years when we were owned by the radio station company, there was just always this drumbeat of like, it's coming. All gonna end soon. Just get ready. And thank God, like, we just were ready to party while we could, you know? I mean, it just felt like that. And it may not be everybody. I don't know if you did a survey of everybody. Maybe it wouldn't feel like that with everybody. But for me, I felt like compared to where we've been in the past, I mean, some of the dark days of magazines where you feel like, well, this is it.
Yeah.
You know, or when different publications go under or stop doing long form altogether and you're like, what is happening? But we're still able to do this. And not just that, but like growing with doing podcasts and books and some other stuff going. It's just like, I can't complain about any of this shit. I mean, this is amazing. So I think part of it is a unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
But that unique situation that came after years of not having it.
Right.
You know, where you were definitely feeling like, well, any minute this is going to end. So enjoy while you can.
Right. Well, it also seems really significant to me that that's how it felt to you on day one, too.
Oh, God. Totally.
Like, if you jumped on this ship and the minute you got on it, everyone was like, this can sink at any time. Just so we're clear, this can go down at any time.
Right.
And there have been moments over the last 25 years where the ship has felt like strong and riding high.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's been other times where it's like taking on tons of water.
Oh, yeah.
And you got through that.
Right.
That makes some sense to me.
I think that's got to be part. It's like if you've lived through the Great Depression, suddenly like any other economic crisis, like pfft, whatever.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
like these are small things, you know, you can get through this. It's like, but there were some things where it just felt like, well, it's been fun, everybody.
Yeah. But also yeah. What I'm hearing you say is like the thing that you want to be doing is this very specific work in this very specific place.
Yeah.
And you get to do it.
Right. So, well, it's been great, Max. That's my story. That's it. Yeah, that's true. I don't know what to say. I know that sounds... I know that there's some people who I've talked to who think that's really lame. And maybe it's... Maybe, you know, I mean, I can see how someone might think it's limiting or boring. It's just endlessly fascinating to me. That's... I don't know what else to say about it.
I don't think it's... lame or boring.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's lucky and rare.
Yeah. That's how I feel. And I still wake up and can't believe that I get to do it.
Well, it's definitely a good sign that you're not going to the library and pulling out a giant
media jobs
book that says media jobs.
I would love to actually get my hands on it.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure. You go?
So if you think about that moment, pulling out that book in the library,
uh-huh.
What would that Katie think about where you're at now?
I don't know. Probably surprise, because I can't really express my cluelessness. I had no idea how to do life, period. Like, I just didn't, I didn't have a, I but also, like, what else was it going to be? I mean, there were other things that I was interested in doing. I think I was trying to get into film. And that could have been fun, too. I think I could have had a total blast doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first moved down here, I was going to do furniture restoration. but then I just couldn't get an in. So maybe if I'd had an in, I would be doing that.
Yeah, if there had just been a book in the library, furniture restoration jobs.
Furniture restoration jobs. Maybe I would have done that.
I got to tell you, I feel like that's as good an answer to why this conversation has felt different than other ones I've had as anything else. Katie, thank you so much for doing it.
This is fun, Max. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Seth Kelly edited this episode. Susan Peterson handled the show notes. Thanks to both of them. Thanks to everyone at Vox with whom we make this show. Thanks very much to Patrick Michaels, who engineered this at the Texas Monthly offices. Thank you so much, Patrick. And thank you so much, Katie Vine, for taking some time and talking to me about how you do this work. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.